Catching Viktor Dashkov off guard was one of the greatest joys of my life. I had that satisfaction now, seeing his eyebrows rise in astonishment. It wasn't easy proposing something a master schemer like him hadn't already considered.
"Interesting," he said at last. "I may have underestimated you, Rose. That's a brilliant deduction on your part."
"Well, it wasn't exactly my deduction." Viktor waited expectantly. Even Robert snapped out of his daze and focused on me. It was creepy. "It was Tatiana's. I mean, not her deduction. She said it directly. Well, that is, the note she left for me did. Why was I rambling in front of these guys? At least I surprised Viktor again."
"Tatiana Ivashkov left you a note with clandestine information? Whatever for?"
I bit my lip and turned my attention over to one of the paintings. It showed an elegant Maroi woman with those same jade-green eyes most Dashkovs and Dragomirs shared. I suddenly wondered if perhaps Robert had formed this dream in some Dashkov mansion from their childhood. Movement in my periphery made me instantly turn back to the brothers. Viktor rose and took a few steps toward me, curiosity and cunning all over him.
"There's more. What else did she tell you? She knew she was in danger. She knew this law was part of it. But it wasn't the only thing, was it?"
I remained silent, but a crazy idea began forming in my mind. I was actually considering seeing if Viktor could help me. Of course, in retrospect, that wasn't such a crazy notion, considering I'd already busted him out of prison to get his help. "Tatiana said..." Should I say it? Should I give up the secret even Lyssa didn't know? If Viktor knew there was another Dragomir, he might use that knowledge for one of his schemes. How? I wasn't sure, but had long learned to expect the unexpected from him. Yet, Viktor knew a lot of Maroi's secrets. I would have enjoyed watching him and Abe match wits, and I didn't doubt that a lot of Viktor's inside knowledge involved the Dragomirs and Dashkovs. I swallowed. "Tatiana said that there was another Dragomir, that Lyssa's dad had an affair, and that if I could find whoever this is, it'll give Lyssa her power back on the council." When Viktor and Robert exchanged shocked looks, I knew my plan had backfired. Viktor wasn't going to give me insight. Instead, I'd been the one to just yield valuable information. Damn. He turned his attention back to me, his expression speculative.
"So, Eric Dragomir wasn't the saint he so often played."
I balled my fists. "Don't slam her dad."
"Wouldn't dream of it. I liked Eric, immensely. But yes, if this is true, then Tatiana is right. Vasilisa technically has family backing, and her liberal views would certainly cause friction on a council that never seems to change their ways."
He chuckled.
"Yes, I can definitely see that upsetting many people, including a murderer who wants to oppress Dompierre's. I imagine he or she wouldn't want this knowledge to get out."
"Someone already tried to get rid of records linking Lyssa's dad to a mistress." I again spoke without thinking and hated myself for it. I didn't want to give the brothers any more info. I didn't want to play like we were all working together here.
"And let me guess," said Viktor. "That's what you're trying to do, isn't it? Find this Dragomir bastard?"
"Hey, don't—"
"It's just an expression," he interrupted. "If I know you two, and I feel confident I do, Vasilisa is desperately trying to clear your name back at court while you and Belikov are off on a sexually charged adventure to find her brother or sister."
"You don't know anything about us," I growled. Sexually charged indeed. He shrugged.
"Your face says it all. And really, it's not a bad idea. Not a great one either, but not bad. Give the Dragomir family a quorum, and you'll have a voice speaking on your behalf on the council. I don't suppose you have any leads.
We're working on it, I replied evasively. Victor looked at Robert. I knew the two didn't have any psychic communication, but as they exchanged glances, I had a feeling they were both thinking the same thing and confirming with each other. At last, Victor nodded and turned back to me.
Very well, then. We'll help you.
He made it sound like he was reluctantly agreeing to do me a big favor.
We don't need your help.
Of course you do. You're out of your league, Rose. You're wandering into a nest of ugly, complex politics. Something you have no experience with. There's no shame in acknowledging that. Just as I'm not ashamed to admit that in an irrational, ill-planned fist fight, you would certainly prove superior.
Another backhanded compliment. We're doing just fine. We have an alchemist helping us.
There.
That would show him who was out of whose league. And to my credit, he did look slightly impressed. Slightly.
Better than I expected. Has your alchemist come up with a location or any lead yet?
She's working on it, I repeated. He sighed in frustration.
We're going to need time then, aren't we? Both for Vasilisa to investigate Cord and you to start tracking this child.
You're the one who acts like you know everything, I pointed out.
I figured you'd know something about this. To my chagrin, no.
Victor didn't really sound all that put out.
But as soon as we get a thread, I assure you I'll be essential in unraveling it.
He walked over to his brother and patted Robert's arm comfortingly. Robert stared back adoringly.
We'll visit you again. Let us know when you have something useful, and then we'll meet up with you.
My eyes widened.
You'll do no such...
I hesitated. I'd let Victor escape in Las Vegas. Now he was offering to come to me. Maybe I could repair that mistake and make good on my earlier threat to him. Quickly, I tried to cover my lapse of speech.
How do I know I can trust you?
You can't, he said bluntly. You've got to take it on faith that the enemy of your enemy is your friend.
I've always hated that saying. You'll always be my enemy. I was a bit surprised when Robert suddenly came to life. He glared and stepped forward.
My brother is a good man, Shadow Girl. If you hurt him, you'll pay. And next time you won't come back. The world of the dead won't give you up a second time.
I knew better than to take the threats of a crazy man seriously, but his last words sent a chill through me. Your brother is a psycho. Enough, enough.
Victor again gave Robert a reassuring pat on the arm. Still scowling at me, the younger Dashkov brother backed off. But I was willing to bet that invisible wall was back in place.
This does us no good. We're wasting time, which is something we don't have enough of. We need more. The Monarch elections will start any day now, and Tatiana's murderer could have a hand in those if there really was some agenda going on. We need to slow down the elections, not just to thwart the assassin, but also to give all of us time to accomplish our tasks.
I was getting tired of all this.
Yeah, and how do you propose we do that?
Victor smiled.
By running Vasilisa as a candidate for queen.
Seeing as this was Victor Dashkov we were dealing with, I really shouldn't have been surprised by anything he said. It was a testament to his level of craziness that he continually caught me unprepared.
That, I declared, is impossible.
Not really,
he replied. I threw my hands up in exasperation. Haven't you been paying attention to what we've been talking about? The whole point is to get Lyssa full family rights with the Moroi. She can't even vote. How could she run for queen?
Actually, the law says she can. According to the way the nomination policy is written, one person from each royal line may run for the monarch's position. That's all it says. One person from each line may run. There is no mention of how many people need to be in her family, as there is for her to vote on the council. She simply needs 3 nominations, and the law doesn't specify which family they'd come from.
Victor spoke in such a precise, crisp way that he might as well have been reciting from a legal book. I wondered if he had all the laws memorized. I supposed if you were going to make a career of breaking laws, you might as well know them.
Whoever wrote that law probably assumed the candidates would have family members. They just didn't bother spelling it out. That's what people will say if Lyssa runs. They'll fight it.
They can fight it all they want. Those who are denying her a council spot base it on one line in the law books that mentions another family member. If that's their argument, that every detail must count, then they'll have to do the same for the election laws, which, as I have said, do not mention family backing. That's the beauty of this loophole. Her opponents can't have it both ways.
A smile twisted at Victor's lips, supremely confident.
I assure you, there is absolutely nothing in the wording that prevents her from doing this.
How about her age? I pointed out. The princes and princesses who run are always old. The title of prince or princess went to a family's oldest member, and traditionally that was the person who ran for king or queen. The family could decide to nominate someone else more fitting, but even then, to my knowledge, it was always someone older and experienced.
The only age restriction is full adulthood, said Victor. She's 18. She qualifies. The other families have much larger pools to draw from. So naturally, they'd select someone who seemed more experienced. In the Dragomir case? Well, that's not an option, now is it? Besides, young monarchs aren't without precedence. There was a very famous queen, Alexandra, who wasn't much older than Vasilisa. Very well loved, very extraordinary. Her statue is by the court's church.
I shifted uncomfortably. Actually, it's, not there anymore. It kind of blew up. Victor just stared. He'd apparently heard about my escape, but not all the details.
It's not important, I said hastily, feeling guilty that I'd been indirectly responsible for blowing up a renowned queen.
The whole idea about using Lyssa is ridiculous.
You won't be the only one who thinks so, Victor said. They'll argue. They'll fight. In the end, the law will prevail. They'll have to let her run. She'll go through the tests and probably pass. Then when voting comes, the laws that govern those procedures reference a family member assisting with the vote.
My head was spinning by now. I felt mentally exhausted listening to all these legal loopholes and technicalities.
Just come right out and put it in simple language, I ordered.
When voting comes, she won't be eligible. She has no family to fulfill the role required at the actual election. In other words, the law says she can run and take the tests. Yet people can't actually vote for her because she has no family.
That's idiotic.
Agreed.
He paused. I don't think either of us ever expected to concur on something. Lyssa would hate this. She would never, ever want to be queen.
Are you not following this?
Exclaimed Victor.
She won't be queen.
She can't.
It's a badly written law for a situation no one foresaw. It's a mess. And it will bog down the election so badly that we'll have extra time to find Vasilisa's sibling and find out who really killed Tatiana.
Hey, I told you. There's no we here. I'm not going to... Victor and Robert exchanged looks.
Get Vasilisa nominated, said Victor abruptly. We'll be in touch soon on where to meet you for the Dragomir search.
That's not...
I woke up. My immediate reaction was to swear, but then remembering where I was, I kept my expletives inside my own head. I could make out Dimitri's silhouette in the corner, alert and watchful, and didn't want him to know I was awake. Closing my eyes, I shifted into a more comfortable position, hoping for true sleep that would block out the Dashkov brothers and their ridiculous schemes. Lyssa running for queen? It was crazy. And yet, it really wasn't much crazier than most of the things I did. Putting that aside, I let my body relax and felt the tug of true sleep start to take me down. Emphasis on start. Because suddenly, I felt another spirit dream materializing around me. Apparently, this was going to be a busy night. Chapter 11. I braced myself, expecting to see the Dashkov brothers appear again with some last-minute advice. Instead, I saw... Adrian! I ran across the garden I'd appeared in and threw my arms around him. He hugged me back just as tightly and lifted me off the ground.
Little Dompia, he said once he put me down again.
His arms stayed around my waist.
I've missed you.
I've missed you too. And I meant it. The last couple days and their bizarre events had completely unhinged my life, and being with him, even in a dream, was comforting. I stood on my tiptoes and kissed him, enjoying a small moment of warmth and peace as our lips met.
Are you okay?
He asked when I broke away.
No one will tell me much about you. Your old man says you're safe and that the alchemist would let him know if anything went wrong.
I didn't bother telling Adrian that probably wasn't true, seeing as Abe didn't know we'd gone freelancing with some backwoods vampires.
I'm fine, I assured Adrian.
Mostly bored, we're holed up in this dive of a town. I don't think anyone will come looking for us. I don't think they'd want to. A look of relief spread over his handsome face, and it occurred to me just how worried he was.
I'm glad. Rose, you can't imagine what it's like. They aren't just questioning people who might have been involved. The Guardians are making all sorts of plans to hunt you down.
There's all this talk about deadly force.
Well, they won't find me. I'm somewhere pretty remote.
Very remote.
I wish I could have gone with you.
He still looked concerned, and I pressed a finger to his lips.
No, don't say that. You're better off where you are.
And better not to be associated with me any more than you already are. Have you been questioned?
Yeah, they didn't get anything useful out of me. Too tight an alibi. They brought me in when I went to find Mikhail because we talked to...
I know. Joe. Adrian's surprise was brief.
Little Dompia, you've been spying.
It's hard not to.
You know, as much as I like the idea of having someone always know when you're in trouble, I'm still kind of glad I don't have anyone bound to me. Not sure I'd want them looking in my head.
I don't think anyone would want to look in your head either. One person living Adrian Ivashkov's life is hard enough. Amusement flickered in his eyes, but it faded when I switched back to business. Anyway, yeah, I overheard Lyssa's, interrogation of Joe. That's serious stuff. What did Mikhail say? If Joe lied, that clears half the evidence against me. It also theoretically killed Adrian's alibi.
Well, not quite half. It would have been better if Joe said you were in your room during the murder instead of admitting he's a flake who doesn't remember anything. It also would have been better if he hadn't said all this under Lyssa's compulsion. Mikhail can't report that.
I sighed. Hanging out with spirit users, I'd started to take compulsion for granted. It was easy to forget that among Maroi it was taboo, the kind of thing you'd get in serious trouble for. In fact, Lyssa wouldn't just get in trouble for illicitly using it. She could also be accused of simply making Joe say whatever she wanted. Anything he said in my favor would be suspect. No one would believe it.
Also,
added Adrian, looking dismayed,
if what Joe said gets out, The world would learn about my mother's misguided acts of love.
I'm sorry, I said, putting my arms around him. He complained about his parents all the time, but really did care about his mother. Finding out about her bribery had to be tough for him, and I knew Tatiana's death still pained him. It seemed I was around a lot of men in anguish lately. Although, I really am glad she cleared you of any connection.
It was stupid of her.
If anyone finds out, she'll be in serious trouble. What's Mikhail's advice, then?
He's going to find Joe and question him privately. Go from there. For now, there's not much more we can do with the info. It's useful for us, but not for the legal system.
Yeah, I said, trying not to feel disheartened. I guess it's better than nothing. Adrian nodded and then brushed away his dark mood in that easy way of his. Still keeping his arms around me, he pulled back slightly, smiling as he looked down at me.
Nice dress, by the way.
The topic change caught me by surprise, though I should have been used to it with him by now. Following his gaze, I noticed I was wearing an old dress of mine, the sexy black dress I'd had on when Victor had unleashed a lust charm on Dimitri and me. Since Adrian hadn't dressed me for the dream, my subconscious had dictated my appearance. I was kind of astonished it had chosen this. Oh. I suddenly felt embarrassed but didn't know why. My own clothes are kind of beat up. I guess I wanted something to counteract that.
Well, it looks good on you.
Adrian's fingers slid along the strap.
Really good.
Even in a dream, the touch of his finger made my skin tingle. Watch it, Ivashkov. We've got no time for this.
We're asleep. What else are we going to do?
My protests were muffled in a kiss. I sank into it. One of his hands slid down the side of my thigh, near the dress's edge, and it took a lot of mental energy to convince myself that him pulling the dress up was probably not going to clear my name. I reluctantly moved back. We're going to figure out who killed Tatiana, I said, trying to catch my breath.
There's no we, he
said, echoing the line I'd just used on Victor.
There's me, and Lyssa, and Christian, and the rest of our misfit friends.
He stroked my hair and then drew me close again, brushing a kiss against my cheek.
Don't worry, little Dampier. You take care of yourself. Just stay where you are.
I can't, I said. Don't you get it? I can't just do nothing. The words were out of my mouth before I could stop them. It was one thing to protest my inactivity with Dimitri. But with Adrian, I needed to make him and everyone else at court think I was doing the right thing. You have to. We'll take care of you. He didn't get it, I realized. He didn't understand how badly I needed to do something to help. To his credit, his intentions were good. He thought taking care of me was a big deal. He wanted to keep me safe. But he didn't truly get how agonizing inaction was for me. We'll find this person and stop them from doing whatever it is they want to do. It might take a long time, but we'll fix it.
Time, I murmured against his chest, letting the argument go.
I'd get nowhere convincing him I needed to help my friends, and anyway, I had my own quest now. So much to do, so little time. I stared off into the landscape he'd created. I'd noticed trees and flowers earlier, but only now realized we were in the church's courtyard, the way it had been before Abe's assault. The statue of Queen Alexandra stood intact, her long hair and kind eyes immortalized in stone. The murder investigation really was in my friend's hands for now. But Adrian had been right. It might take a while. I sighed.
Time. We need more time.
Adrian pulled away slightly.
What'd you say?
I stared up at him, biting my lower lip as a million thoughts spun through my mind. I looked again at Alexandra and made my decision, wondering if I was about to set new records in foolishness. I turned back to Adrian and squeezed his hand. I said we need more time, and I know how we can get it, but, well, there's something you have to do for me. And you, probably shouldn't mention it to Lisiette. I had just enough time to deliver my instructions to Adrian, who was as shocked as I'd expected, before Dimitri woke me up for my shift. We switched off with little conversation. He had his usual tough face on, but I could see the lines of fatigue etched upon his features. I didn't want to bother him, yet, with my Victor and Robert encounter, not to mention what I'd just told Adrian to do. There'd be plenty of time for a recap later. Dimitri fell asleep in that easy way of his, and Sydney never stirred the entire time. I envied her for a full night's sleep, but couldn't help a smile as the room grew lighter and lighter. She'd been inadvertently put on a vampire schedule after our all-night adventures. Of course, Lissa was on the same schedule, which meant I couldn't visit her during my watch. Just as well. I needed to keep an eye on this creepy collective we'd stumbled into. These keepers might not want to turn us in, but that didn't make them harmless either. I also hadn't forgotten Sydney's fears about surprise alchemist visits. When late afternoon came for the rest of the world, I heard stirring inside the house. I gently touched Dimitri's shoulder, and he jerked awake instantly. "Easy," I said, unable to hide a smile. "Just a wake-up call. Sounds like our redneck friends are getting up." This time, our voices woke Sydney. She rolled over toward us, her eyes squinting at the light coming through the badly screened window. "What time is it?" she asked, stretching her limbs. "Not sure." I had no watch. "Probably past midday. 3, 4. She sat up almost as quickly as Dimitri had. "In the afternoon?" The sunlight gave her the answer. "Damn you guys and your unholy schedule." "Did you just say damn? Isn't that against alchemist rules?" I teased. "Sometimes it's necessary." She rubbed her eyes and glanced toward the door. The faint noises I'd heard in the rest of the house were louder now, audible even to her ears. "I guess we need a plan." "We have one," I said. "Find Lissa's sibling." "I never entirely agreed to that," she reminded me. "And you guys keep thinking I can just magically type away like some movie hacker to find all your answers." "Well, at least it's a place to..." A thought occurred to me. One that could seriously mess things up. "Crap! Your laptop won't even work out here." "It's got a satellite modem, but it's the battery we have to worry about." Sydney sighed and stood up, smoothing her rumpled clothes with dismay. "I need a coffee shop or something." "I think I saw one in a cave down the road," I said. That almost got a smile from her. "There's gotta be some town close by where I could use my laptop."
"But it's probably not a good idea to take the car out anywhere in this state," said Dimitri. "Just in case someone at the motel got your license plate number."
"I know," she said grimly. "I was thinking about that too." Our brilliant scheming was interrupted by a knock at the door. Without waiting for an answer, Sarah stuck her head inside and smiled.
"Oh, good. You're all awake. We're getting breakfast ready if you want to join us."
Through the doorway, a sense of what seemed like a normal breakfast drifted in. Bacon, eggs. The bread had gotten me through the night, but I was ready for real food and willing to roll the dice on whatever Raymond's family had to offer. In the house's main section, we found a flurry of domestic activity. Raymond appeared to be cooking something over the fireplace while Paulette set the long table. It already had a platter of perfectly ordinary scrambled eggs and more slices of yesterday's bread. Raymond rose from the fireplace, holding a large metal sheet covered in crisp bacon. A smile split his bearded face when he spotted us. The more of these keepers I saw, the more I kept noticing something. They made no attempts to hide their fangs. From childhood, my Maroi were taught to smile and speak in a way that minimized fang exposure, in case they were out in human cities. There was nothing like that here.
"Good morning,"
said Raymond, carefully pushing the bacon onto another platter on the table.
"I hope you're all hungry."
"Do you think that's, like, real bacon?" I whispered to Sydney and Dimitri. And not like squirrel or something.
Looks real to me, said Dimitri.
I'd say so too, said Sydney. Though I guarantee it's from their own pigs and not a grocery store.
Dimitri laughed at whatever expression crossed my face.
I always love seeing what worries you. Strigoi? No. Questionable food? Yes.
What about Strigoi?
Joshua and Angeline entered the house. He had a bowl of blackberries and she was pushing the little kids along. From their squirming and dirty faces, they clearly wanted to go back outside. It was Angeline who had asked the question. Dimitri covered for my squeamishness.
Just talking about some of Rose's Strigoi kills.
Joshua came to a standstill and stared at me, those pretty blue eyes wide with amazement.
You've killed the lost, or Strigoi?
I admired his attempt to use our term.
How many?
I shrugged. I don't really know anymore.
Don't you use the marks?
Raymond scolded.
I didn't think the tainted had abandoned those.
The marks, yeah, our tattoos? We do. I turned around and lifted up my hair. I heard a scuffling of feet and then felt a finger touching my skin. I flinched and whipped back around just in time to see Joshua lowering his hand sheepishly.
Sorry,
he said.
I've just never seen some of these. Only the Molniya marks. That's how we count our Strigoi kills. You've got a lot. The S-shaped mark is unique to them,
said Raymond disapprovingly. That look was quickly replaced by admiration.
The others, the Zvedza.
This earned gasps from Joshua and Angeline and a what? From me.
The battle mark, said Dimitri. Not many people call it Zvedza anymore. It means star.
Huh. Makes sense, I said. The tattoo was, in fact, kind of shaped like a star and was given when someone had fought in a big enough battle to lose count of Strigoi kills. After all, there were only so many Molniya marks you could cram on your neck. Joshua smiled at me in a way that made my stomach flutter just a little. Maybe he was part of a pseudo-Amish cult, but that didn't change the fact that he was still good-looking.
Now I understand how you could have killed the Tainted Queen.
It's probably fake, said Angeline.
I'd been about to protest the queen-killing part, but her comment derailed me.
It is not! I earned it when Strigoi attacked our school, and then there were plenty more I took down after that.
The mark can't be that uncommon, said Dimitri. Your people must have big Strigoi fights every once in a while.
Not really,
said Joshua, his eyes still on me.
Most of us have never fought or even seen the lost. They don't really bother us.
That was surprising. If ever there was a Strigoi target, a group of Moroi, Dompiers, and humans out in the middle of nowhere would be it. Why not? I asked. Raymond winked at me.
Because we fight back.
I pondered his enigmatic statement as the family sat down to eat. Again, I thought about the entire community's willingness to fight when we'd first arrived. Was it really enough to scare off Strigoi? Not much scared them, but maybe certain things were too much of an inconvenience to deal with. I wondered what Dimitri's opinion would be on that. His own family had come from a community that separated itself somewhat from mainstream Moroi life, but it was nothing like this. All of this spun in my mind while we ate and talked. The keeper still had a lot more questions about us and Tatiana. The only one not participating was Angeline. She ate as little as Sydney and kept watching me with a scowl.
We need some supplies, said Sydney abruptly, interrupting me in the middle of a gruesome story.
I didn't mind, but the others looked disappointed.
Where's the nearest town that would have a coffee shop or any restaurant?
Well, said Paulette. Rubiesville is a little over an hour north, but we have plenty of food here for you.
It's not about food, I said quickly. Yours has been great. I glanced at Sydney.
An hour is not so bad, right?
She nodded and then glanced hesitantly at Raymond.
Is there any way we could borrow a car?
The next words clearly caused her pain.
I'll leave the keys to mine until we get back.
He arched an eyebrow.
You've got a nice car.
Sydney shrugged.
The less we drive it around here, the better.
He told us we could take his truck and that he probably wouldn't even need to use the CRV. Sydney gave him a tight smile of thanks, but I knew images of vampires joyriding in her car were dancing through her head. We set out soon after that, wanting to be back before the sun went down. People were out and about in the commune, doing chores or whatever else it was they did with their lives. A group of children sat around a dampier reading a book to them, making me wonder what sort of education process they had here. All of the keepers stopped whatever they were doing as we passed, giving us either curious looks or outright smiles. I smiled back occasionally, but mostly kept my eyes ahead. Joshua was escorting us back to the parking lot and managed to walk beside me when we reached the narrow path.
I hope you won't be gone long,
he said.
I'd wanted us to talk more.
Sure, I said. That'd be fun.
He brightened and chivalrously pushed aside a low-hanging branch.
Maybe I can show you my cave.
Wait, what? Don't you live with your dad?
For now, but I'm getting my own place.
There was pride in his voice.
It's not as big as his, of course, but it's a good start. It's almost cleaned out.
That's really, great. Definitely show me when we're back.
The words came easily to my lips, but my mind was pondering the fact that Raymond's house was apparently big. Joshua parted ways from us when we reached Raymond's truck. A big red pickup with a seat that could just barely hold the three of us. Considering the keepers didn't leave the woods much, the truck seemed like it had seen a lot of miles. Or maybe just a lot of years of disuse.
You shouldn't leave him on like that, Dimitri said when we'd been on the road for about 10 minutes.
Surprisingly, Sydney had let him drive. I guess she figured a manly truck deserved a manly driver. Now that we were moving, my mind had focused back on the task at hand, finding the other Dragomir.
Huh?
Joshua, you were flirting with him.
I was not. We were just talking.
Aren't you with Adrian?
Yes,
I exclaimed, glaring at Dimitri. His eyes were fixed on the road.
And that's why I wasn't flirting. How can he read so much into that? Joshua doesn't even like me that way.
Actually, said Sydney, sitting between us,
he does.
I turned my incredulity on her.
How do you know? Did he pass you a note in class or something?
She rolled her eyes.
No, but you and Dimitri are like gods back at camp.
We're outsiders, I reminded her. Tainted.
No, you're renegade Strigoi and queen killers. It might have all been southern charm and hospitality back there, but those people can be savage. They put a big premium on being able to beat people up. And considering how scruffy most of them are, you guys are, well, let's just say you two are the hottest things to walk through there in a while.
You're not hot? I asked.
It's irrelevant, she said, flustered by the comment. Alchemists aren't even on their radar. We don't fight. They think we're weak.
I thought back to the enraptured faces and had to admit that a lot of the people there did have a weathered, worn-out look. Almost. Raymond's family was pretty good-looking, I pointed out. I heard a grunt from Dimitri, who no doubt read this as evidence of me flirting with Joshua.
Yeah, she said. Because they're probably the most important family in town. They eat better, probably don't have to work in the sun as much. That kind of stuff makes a difference.
There was no more talk of flirting as we continued the drive. We made good time to Rubiesville, which looked eerily similar to the first town we'd stayed in. When we stopped at what appeared to be Rubiesville's only gas station, Sydney ran inside to ask a few questions. She came back, reporting that there was indeed a cafe of sorts where she could plug in her laptop and try to look up what we needed. She ordered coffee, and we sat there with her, too full from breakfast to order anything substantial. After a couple dirty looks from a waitress who seemed to regard us as loiterers, Dimitri and I decided to take a walk around town. Sydney looked almost as pleased as the waitress about this. I don't think she liked having us hover around. I'd given Sydney a hard time about West Virginia, but I had to admit the scenery was beautiful. Soaring trees full of summer leaves surrounded the town like an embrace. Beyond them, mountains loomed, very different from the ones I'd grown up with near St. Vladimir's. These were rolling and green, covered in more trees. Most of the mountains surrounding St. Vladimir's had been stony and jagged, often with snowy peaks. A strange sense of nostalgia came over me, thinking back to Montana. There was a good possibility I'd never see it again. If I spent the rest of my life on the run, St. Vladimir's was the last place I could go. If I was caught, well, then I'd definitely never get to see Montana again. Or any place, I murmured, speaking out loud before I could catch myself.
Hmm?
Asked Dimitri. I was just thinking about if the Guardians find us. I never realized how much there was I wanted to do and see. Suddenly, that's all at stake, you know? We moved off to the side of the road as an orange pickup came driving by. Children out of school for the summer screeched and laughed in the back of it. Okay, suppose my name isn't cleared and we never find the real murderer. What's the next best-case scenario? Me, always running, always hiding? That'll be my life. For all I know, I will have to go live with the Keepers.
I don't think it'll come to that, said Dimitri. Abe and Sydney would help you find someplace safe.
Is there a safe place? For real? Adrian said the Guardians are increasing their efforts to find us. They've got the Alchemists and probably human authorities looking for us, too. No matter where we go, we'll run the risk of being spotted. Then we'll have to move on. It'll be like that forever.
You'll be alive, he pointed out. That's what matters. Enjoy what you have. Every little detail of wherever you are. Don't focus on where you aren't.
Yeah, I admitted, trying to follow his advice. The sky seemed a little bluer, the birds a little louder. I suppose I shouldn't whine over the dream places I won't get to see. I should be grateful I get to see anything at all, and that I'm not living in a cave. He glanced over at me and smiled, something unreadable in his eyes.
Where do you want to go?
What, right now? I glanced around, sizing up our options. There was a bait and tackle store, a drug store, and an ice cream parlor. I had a feeling that last one would be a necessary trip before leaving town.
No, in the world.
I eyed him warily. Sydney's going to be pissed if we take off for Istanbul or something. This got me full-fledged laughter.
Not what I had in mind. Come on.
I followed him toward what looked like the bait and tackle store and then noticed a small building tucked behind it. Naturally, his sharp eyes had seen what I missed, probably because I'd been fixated on the ice cream. Rubiesville Public Library.
Whoa, hey,
I said. One of the few perks of graduating was avoiding places like this.
It's probably air-conditioned,
he pointed out. I looked down at my sweat-soaked tank top and noticed a faint pink tinge to my skin. With my tanned complexion, I rarely burned, but this was some serious sun, even so late in the day. Lead on, I told him. The library was mercifully cool, though even smaller than the one at St. Vladimir's. With some uncanny sense, or maybe just a knowledge of the Dewey Decimal System, Dimitri led us over to the travel section, which consisted of about 10 books, three of which were about West Virginia. He frowned.
Not quite what I expected.
He scanned the shelf twice and then pulled out a large, bright-colored one entitled 100 Best Places to Visit in the World.
We sat down cross-legged on the floor, and he handed me the book.
No way, comrade, I said. I know books are a journey of the imagination, but I don't think I'm up for that today.
Just take it, he said. Close your eyes and flip randomly to a page.
It seemed silly considering everything else going on in our life, but his face said he was serious. Indulging him, I closed my eyes and selected a page in the middle. I opened to it.
Mitchell, South Dakota? I exclaimed. Remembering I was in a library, I lowered my voice.
Out of all the places in the world, that makes the top 100? He was smiling again, and I'd forgotten how much I'd missed that.
Read it.
Located 90 minutes outside of Sioux Falls, Mitchell is home to the Corn Palace. I looked up at him in disbelief.
Corn Palace?
He scooted over next to me, leaning close to look at the pictures.
I figured it'd be made of corn husks, he noted.
The pictures actually showed what looked like a Middle Eastern, or even Russian-style building with turrets and onion domes.
Me too.
Reluctantly, I added, I'd visit it. I bet they have great t-shirts.
And?
He said, a sly look in his eyes.
I bet no guardians would look for us there.
I made no attempts to conceal my laughter, imagining us living as fugitives in the Corn Palace for the rest of our lives. My amusement brought us a scolding from a librarian, and we quieted as Dimitri took his turn. São Paulo, Brazil. Then my turn, Honolulu, Hawaii. Back and forth we passed the book, and before long, we were both lying on the floor, side by side, sharing mixed reactions as we continued our global tour of the imagination, our arms and legs just barely touched. If anyone had told me 48 hours ago that I'd be lying in a library with Dimitri, reading a travel book, I would have said they were crazy. Almost as crazy was the realization that I was doing something perfectly ordinary and casual with him. Since the moment we'd met, our lives had been about secrecy and danger. And really, those were still the dominant themes in our lives. But in those quiet couple of hours, time seemed to stand still. We were at peace. We were friends. Florence, Italy, I read. Pictures of elaborate churches and galleries filled the page. Sydney wants to go there. She wanted to study there, actually. If Abe could have managed that, I think she would have served him for life.
She's still pretty obedient, Dimitri remarked. I don't know her well, but I'm pretty sure Abe's got something on her.
He got her out of Russia, back to the U.S.
He shook his head. It's got to be more than that. Alchemists are loyal to their order. They don't like us. She hides it. They're trained to. But every minute with the Keepers is agony. For her to help us and betray her superiors, she owes him for some serious reason.
We both paused a moment, wondering what mysterious arrangement my father had with her.
It's irrelevant, though. She's helping us, which is what matters. And we should probably get back to her.
I knew he was right, but hated to go. I wanted to stay here, in this illusion of tranquility and safety, letting myself believe I might really make it to the Parthenon or even the Corn Palace someday. I handed the book back to him. One more. He picked his random page and opened the book. His smile fell.
St. Petersburg.
A weird mix of feelings entangled themselves in my chest. Nostalgia, because the city was beautiful. Sorrow, because my visit had been tainted by the awful task I'd gone there to do. Dimitri stared at the page for a long time, wistfulness on his face. It occurred to me then that, despite his earlier pep talk, he had to be experiencing what I did for Montana. Our old favorite places were lost to us now. I nudged him gently. Hey, enjoy where you're at, remember? Not where you can't go. He reluctantly shut the book and dragged his eyes away from it.
How'd you get so wise?
He teased. I had a good teacher. We smiled at each other. Something occurred to me. All this time, I'd figured he'd helped break me out because of Lissa's orders. Maybe there was more to it. Is that why you escaped with me? I asked. To see what parts of the world he could? His surprise was brief.
You don't need me to be wise, Rose. You're doing fine on your own. Yes, that was part of it. Maybe I would have been welcomed back eventually. But there was the risk I wouldn't. After being Strogoi.
He stumbled over the words a little.
I gained a new appreciation for life. It took a while. I'm still not there. We're talking about focusing on the present, not the future. But it's my past that haunts me. Faces. Nightmares. But the farther I get from that world of death, the more I want to embrace life. The smell of these books and the perfume you wear. The way the light bends through that window. Even the taste of breakfast with the keepers.
You're a poet now.
No, just starting to realize the truth. I respect the law and the way our society runs. But there was no way I could risk losing life in some cell after only just finding it again. I wanted to run, too. That's why I helped you. That end.
What? I studied him, desperately wishing he wasn't so good at keeping emotions off his face. I knew him well. I understood him. But he could still hide things from me. He sat up, not meeting my eyes.
It doesn't matter. Let's go back to Sydney and see if she found out anything. Although, as much as I hate to say it, I think it's unlikely.
I know. I stood with him, still wondering what else he would have said. She probably gave up and started playing Minesweeper. We headed back toward the cafe, stopping briefly for ice cream. Eating it while we walked proved quite the challenge. The sun was nearing the horizon, painting everything orange and red. But the heat lingered. Enjoy it, Rose, I told myself. The colors, the taste of chocolate. Of course I'd always loved chocolate. My life didn't need to be on the line for me to enjoy dessert. We reached the cafe and found Sydney bent over her laptop, with a barely eaten Danish and what was probably her fourth cup of coffee. We slid into seats beside her. How's it? Hey, you are playing Minesweeper! I tried to peer closer at her screen, but she turned it from me. You're supposed to be finding a connection to Eric's mistress. I already did, she said simply. Dimitri and I exchanged astonished looks. But I don't know how useful it'll be. Anything will be useful, I proclaimed. What did you find? After trying to track down all those bank records and transactions, and let me tell you, that is not fun at all, I finally found a small piece of info. The bank account we have now is a newer one. It was moved from another bank about 5 years ago. The old account was still a Jane Doe, but it did have a next of kin reference in the event something happened to the account holder. I could hardly breathe. Financial transactions were lost on me, but we were about to get something solid. A real name? Sydney nodded. Sonia Karp. Chapter 12. Dimitri and I both froze as the shock of that name hit us. Sydney, glancing between our faces, gave us a dry smile. I take it you know who that is? Of course, I exclaimed. She was my teacher. She went crazy and turned Strogoi. Sydney nodded. I know. My eyes widened further. She's not the one who had an affair with Lissa's dad, is she? Oh, dear God. That would be one of the most unexpected developments in the roller coaster that was my life. I couldn't even begin to process the effects of that. Not likely, she said.
The account was opened several years before she was added as the beneficiary, which was right when she turned 18. So if we're assuming the account was created around the time the baby was born, then she would have been way too young. Sonia's probably a relative. My earlier astonishment was giving way to excitement, and I could see the same thing happening to Dimitri.
"You must have records about her family," he said. "Or if not, Sumroy probably does. Who's close to Sonia? Does she have a sister?"
Sydney shook her head. "No, that'd be an obvious choice, though. Unfortunately, she has other family. Tons of it. Her parents both came from giant families, so she has lots of cousins. Even some of her aunts are the right age."
"We can look them up, right?" I asked.
A thrill of anticipation was running through me. I honestly hadn't expected this much information. True, it was small, but it was something. If Sonia Karp was related to Eric's mistress, that had to be something we could track.
"There's a lot of them," Sydney shrugged.
"I mean, yeah, we could. It'd take a long time to find everyone's life history, and even then, especially if this was covered up enough, we'd have a hard time finding out if any of them is the woman we're looking for, or even if any of them know who she is." Dimitri's voice was low and thoughtful when he spoke.
"One person knows who Jane Doe is."
Sydney and I both looked at him expectantly.
"Sonia Karp," he replied.
I threw up my hands. "Yeah, but we can't talk to her. She's a lost cause. Mikhail Tanner spent over a year hunting her and couldn't find her. If he can't, then we're not going to be able to." Dimitri turned away from me and stared out the window. His brown eyes filled with sorrow, his thoughts momentarily far away from us. I didn't entirely understand what was happening, but that peaceful moment in the library, where Dimitri had smiled and shared in the daydream of an ordinary life, had vanished. And not just the moment. That Dimitri had vanished. He was back in his fierce mode, carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders again. At last, he sighed and looked back at me.
"That's because Mikhail didn't have the right connections."
"Mikhail was her boyfriend," I pointed out. "He had more connections than anyone else." Dimitri didn't acknowledge my comment. Instead, he grew pensive again. I could see turmoil behind his eyes. Some inner war. At last, it must have been decided.
"Does your phone have reception out here?"
he asked her. She nodded, reaching into her purse and handing him her phone. He held it a moment, looking like it caused him total agony to touch it. At last, with another sigh, he stood up and headed for the door. Sydney and I exchanged questioning looks and then both followed him. She lagged behind me, having to toss cash on the table and grab her laptop. I emerged outside just as Dimitri finished dialing a number and put the phone to his ear. Sydney joined us, and a moment later, the person on the other end of the line must have answered.
"Boris?"
asked Dimitri. That was all I understood because the rest was a string of rapid Russian. A strange sensation spread over me as he spoke. I was confused, lost because of the language. But there was more than that. I felt chilled, my pulse raced with fear. That voice. I knew that voice. It was his voice and yet not his voice. It was the voice of my nightmares, a voice of coldness and cruelty. Dimitri was playing Strigoi. Well, playing was really too gentle of a word. Pretending was a better way to describe it. Whatever it was pretty damned convincing. Beside me, Sydney frowned, but I didn't think she was experiencing what I was. She had never known him as a Strigoi. She didn't have those horrible memories. His change in demeanor had to be obvious, but as I glanced at her face, I realized she was focused on following the conversation. I'd forgotten she knew Russian. "What's he saying?" I whispered. Her frown deepened, either from the conversation or me distracting her.
"He... He sounds like he's talking to someone he hasn't spoken to in a while. Dimitri's accusing this person of slacking off while he's been away. She fell silent, continuing her own mental translation. At one point, Dimitri's voice rose in anger, and both Sydney and I flinched. I turned to her questioningly. He's mad about having his authority questioned. I can't tell, but now, it sounds like the other person's groveling. I wanted to know every word, but it had to be hard for her to translate to me and listen at the same time. Dimitri's voice returned to normal levels, though still filled with that terrible menace, and among the flurry of words I heard Sonia Karp and Montana. He's asking about Miss Karp. Sonia? I murmured. She hadn't been my teacher for a long time. I might as well call her Sonia now. Yeah, said Sydney, eyes still on Dimitri. He's asking, telling this person to locate someone else and see if he can find Sonia. This person... She paused to listen again. This person he's asking about sounds like he knows a lot of people in the area she was last seen in. I knew people in this context meant Strigoi. Dimitri had risen quickly in their ranks, asserting his will and power over others. Most Strigoi operated solo, rarely working in groups, but even the lone ones recognized threats and more dominant Strigoi. Dimitri was working his contacts, just as he'd said earlier. If any Strigoi had heard about his transformation and believed it, they wouldn't have been able to pass the news quickly, not with their disorganization. As it was, Dimitri was already having to play leapfrog to find sources who knew other sources who might know Sonia's location. Dimitri grew loud and angry again, his voice becoming, if possible, more sinister. I suddenly felt trapped, and even Sydney looked scared now. She swallowed. He's telling this guy that if he doesn't get answers by tomorrow night, Dimitri's going to find him and rip him apart and... Sydney didn't bother finishing. Her eyes were wide. Use your imagination. It's pretty terrible. I decided then that I was kind of glad I hadn't heard all of the conversation in English. When Dimitri finished the call and returned Sydney's phone, that mask of malice melted from his face. Once again, he was my Dimitri. Dimitri the Dampier. Dejection and despair radiated off him, and he slumped against the cafe's wall, staring upward into the sky. I knew what he was doing. He was trying to calm himself, seize control of the emotions that had to be warring within him. He'd just done something that might give us clues we needed, but it had been at a terrible cost to himself. My fingers twitched. I wanted to put a comforting arm around him or at least pat his shoulder so he'd know he wasn't alone. But I held back, suspecting he wouldn't like it. At last, he turned his gaze back to us. He'd regained his control, at least on the outside.
I've sent someone asking about her, he said wearily. It might not work out. Strigoi are hardly the type to keep a database. But they do occasionally keep an eye on one another. If only for their own self-preservation. We'll find out soon if there are any hits.
Wow, thank you, I said, fumbling at the words. I knew he needed no thanks, but it felt necessary to me. He nodded.
We should get back to the Keepers, unless you think this is a safe place to stay.
I'd rather stay off civilized radar, said Sydney, moving toward the truck. Besides, I want my car keys back. The ride back felt 10 times longer. Dimitri's mood filled up the whole cabin, almost suffocating us with its despair. Even Sydney could feel it. She'd let him drive again, and I couldn't decide if that was a good or bad thing. Would the road distract him from his Strigoi torment? Or would his agony distract him from the road and put us off in a ditch? Fortunately, we made it back safe and sound and found 2 of the keepers waiting for us in the lot, A Maroi woman and a human guy who both looked fierce. I still couldn't shake the strangeness of both races being battle-ready. I wondered if these two were a couple. Back in the camp, we found the communal bonfire ablaze and people sitting out around it, some eating and some just socializing. I'd learned at breakfast that the fire was always there for those who wanted to bond, but that plenty of families kept to their own households as well. We went back to Raymond's house, but only Sarah and Joshua were there. She was cleaning up dishes, and he sat restlessly in a chair. As soon as he caught sight of me at the door, he sprang up, radiant smile on high beam again.
Rose, you're back. We were starting to worry. I mean, not that anything had happened to you, not with your skills, but that maybe you'd just left us.
Not without our car, said Sydney, placing the truck keys on the table. The CRVs were sitting there already, and relief flooded her face as she snatched them up. Sarah offered us leftovers, which we declined, having stocked up on snack food at Rubiesville's gas station.